Hello and welcome aboard this podcast of RTÉ Radio 1's maritime programme Seascapes, which is presented and produced by Marcus Connaughton. You can email the programme seascapes@rte.ie. Hello and welcome aboard this week's edition of your maritime programme, Seascapes. We visit the third largest tall ship in the world, the pride of the Spanish Navy, the Juan Sebastian de Elcano. Hugh Oram has the tale of the world's first ever sports event broadcast on radio over 116 years ago, covering a yacht race. Kieran Devaney is on Tory Island to visit the lighthouse with former keeper and now hotelier Sean Doherty. First on Seascapes this week, we talk to the head of the National Maritime College of Ireland, Conor Moles, about the major contract signed last month with Chevron Shipping.
They literally went out and looked at colleges around the world, and we at the NMCI, through our joint venture partnership with GAC, the ship agent, who have a long-standing relationship with Chevron, entered that competition. What happened was we met with Chevron senior executives four or five times, both in Ireland at the NMCI, in Glasgow, at their support base with Northern Marine, and then finally at their headquarters in San Ramon, where we entered into a week of high-level negotiations. And what came from that was that the NMCI literally won that competition. We signed a deal in Texas 2 weeks ago with the support of the Minister for Enterprise, Trade and Employment on a Enterprise Ireland trade mission. And that deal is focused on training the entire Chevron Officer Corps in Ireland over a four-year period. The course itself will be a two-week course. It'll be split between deck and engine. We'll look very much at the basic skills of junior officers on the deck side, rigging, slinging, crane operations. On the engineering side, we'll be looking at fault finding, purifier overhaul, basic engineering toolbox, and then some joint training, free fall lifeboat, entry into enclosed space, gas testing, the stuff that both deck and engine disciplines engage in. And it's a huge development for the NMCI because it's a very strong indication of the trust that I believe Chevron have in the NMCI and its staff and its facilities. It's very much a recognition of the NMCI, its facilities, and also its staff who have worked for years now in building our reputation and our capability, not just on the academic side, but on the commercial front and the research front. What we'll see from Chevron is a huge investment in terms of physical facilities. We'll have a forecastle head arrangement that will be built by the Bear Island Shipyard, specifically to support this operation. And we'll see Chevron investing in equipment to support the courses themselves. We'll see employment. We'll have both full and part-time instructional staff employed to support this. Outside the actual contract itself, which is the largest maritime training contract in the history of the state, there are some huge benefits in terms of the relationship with Chevron. Up until recently, they would take 2, 3, possibly 5 cadets from the NMCI every year. What we'll see moving forward is Chevron increasing that cadet intake. And in fact, this year alone, they've upped that to 16 cadets. And we'll be looking at 15 to 20 cadets in the coming years. And that can only be strengthened. We're also going to see Chevron looking at relocating their overseas cadets from colleges around the world and placing them in Ireland, which again is a strong sign of their faith in us. Chevron are part of the OCIMF, the OCIMF, the oil industry group that which numbers BP, Exxon, Total, and we believe that if we get it right, which we know we will in training Chevron's officer corps and strengthening that relationship, I believe that we'll see more of the oil majors looking at the NMCI as a place to focus their training in the future. And I think Chevron feel the same way. What it boils down to now, very simply, is for us to ensure that we step up to the mark and deliver on exactly what we've said we would do. And this summer, the first week of July, we'll see the pilot course. And then the third week of August, we'll see the second course, and we'll see the entire of Chevron's senior management here in Ireland to oversee this for 10 days. I think it's a hugely important time for the NMCI and for Ireland in maritime training terms.
Conor Moles, head of the National Maritime College of Ireland, and you can read more on the Seascapes webpage. Earlier this week, the Pride of Spain, the tall ship, the Juan Sebastian de Elcano, paid a visit to Dublin. She last visited the port 15 years ago. Seascapes went aboard on Monday evening at the invitation of the Embassy of Spain, Department of Tourism. We talked to their councillor for tourism, Gonzalo Ceballos, about the vessel.
In the past, the Navy Academy was a single purpose and they came out as officers. Now they also do a civil university degree as industrial engineers. It is our tall ship and it is a training vessel where absolutely all the commanding officers have done their fourth year at the Navy Academy. So it is a very binding experience for them. They meet their colleagues in the academy and they're out in sea 5 months. Shoulder if you have seen. I would say not very many countries can still afford to have a vessel this type, and this one is, she's 87 years old, and we're doing all our efforts to keep her in good shape, see if she turns 100 still at sea. The training sort of expedition they do, this one started. They started in January and they'll go back to port on 13th of July. So they're touching in this instruction cruise, I think 7 or 9 ports. In each of them there is a sort of showing the flag and doing quite like an embassy, a floating embassy of Spain. Well, we're very proud of what the ship shows and who is on board the ship. We tend to look at it, as you mentioned before, a postcard, but it's there are 200 souls on board, and those 200 souls make us proud. So it is very very good for I would say, Spanish Embassy, the Spanish Tourism Board, and the visibility of Spain in Ireland. Today, the President of the Republic was here having, on an official state visit, a lunch on board. It gives us the opportunity to show him as representing all the country, all the Irish citizens, what we have in common, and show off what we can do as, you mentioned, a maritime nation.
We hear next from Commander Fernando Moreau in the magnificent officer's wardroom.
Being a bearer child, the first of Spain and the fifth of Germany, gives to Elcano when he made the trip. And the lemma, the motto, Primus circundedistime in Latin. You was the first made me round the world. And you can see in that coat of arms the species he brought with him. Cinnamon, muscat nut, and clay. Can you see that?
All right. Clove.
Clove. Ah, clove. That's it. Thank you. Yeah. Clove. We can see the photo of the daughter of the President of Spain, the General Primo de Rivera, in 1927. And in that photo, we can see the first officer's crew with our King Alfonso XIII, in just there. There are a lot of photos of our monarchy, and in the middle is the King Alfonso XIII.
And of course, you're about to get a new king.
Yes.
he's a sailor as well, which is somebody who understands the water.
Yes, he loves to sail. Yeah. More than me. Can you explain me why you have a lot of seafood that you don't eat, but in Spain, in Galicia, we fish a lot of, seafood. You have a lot, but you don't.
We have a lot, but unfortunately we're an agricultural economy, and an awful lot of the time our buildings are built with their backs to the sea rather than facing the sea.
Ah, that's incredible.
As we move through the heart of the tall ship and through the engine room, which positively sparkled, we headed back on deck to the castle and talked to this naval officer from Cartagena.
This here is the son of the midshipman. This is called Alcázar, right?
So I don't know if someone told you, but in the ship, if depending on the rank, you go to one place or another, and you have to be in that place. So this is our place for the midshipmen. Officers go on that deck over there, and then sailors here, and then petty officers. So now we're going to go to our wardroom. So you, as you've seen now the captain's one, now you're going to see ours. Yeah, here we are people from the Spanish Navy and the Marines. Yeah, we have 12 Marines in our year. So let's go. So we have like engineering classes and naval classes.
So it's a classroom and your dining room.
It is, yes.
And how many does this room hold?
70, up to 70 people. It's just like us, so that's good. Everybody can get a seat. So here the teacher is on this table here. And we have like this projector. Yes.
And you have a little sing song every once in a while?
I don't play it, some people do. Yeah.
So had you ancestors at sea? Was this something you always wanted to do? And what part of Spain are you from?
Yeah, I'm from Cartagena, which is the east. I'm from a Navy family. My dad and my granddad, they were both in the Naval Academy as well, and in this ship. They both came here, so because this ship is pretty old. It's really old. It's
1928 in Cadiz.
Yeah. Yeah, that's it.
So it's a very proud tradition for you to carry on.
Yeah, of course. It is.
And what about life at sea? How you travelled over, you sailed from New York to here. What was that like?
Well, it's a good experience because it's the first time that I go sailing for such a long time. Well, I did it like to go to America and now again to come back here. And it was different than the first time because you know that to go to America, we have these winds that are always the same direction, they're very easy to sail. But this time, you have like this low pressures all the way, like going behind you and then in front of you. So you have to like study a little bit more the maneuver and see what you have to do to get on time to here, so it's fun.
You can see photographs of this historic tall ship, the Juan Sebastian del Cano, on the Seascapes webpage. A career change is always difficult, but even more so when you're in your 70s and spent most of your working life in one of the loneliest jobs in the world. Sean Doherty was a lighthouse keeper for 50 years. He spent many of those years as a custodian of the Tory Island Light. Those days have gone, and now Sean has made the voyage from one world to another. For Seascapes, Kieran Devaney sailed out into the Atlantic to Tory Island to bring us this story.
The first day that I went on the ship, there was no landing at the station I was going to. There was a landing at another station then. It was a couple of hours steaming further on. But the seas were quite rough, and the southwest coast was more than what I was used to up in Donegal. Appeared to be more moderate with the seas. But seasickness then, on the ship when you were out for a full day, maybe 10 hours at sea, 5 hours steaming to the lighthouses and then steaming back and all that, you know, difficult times. And then maybe for example, going to Slidehead, go to Clifton, get your provisions, go on a van out through sand dunes, down to a donkey then, get your bed bag, your luggage, you had to take your bed, mattress and all with you, and you had to take that with you everywhere you went, maybe get that on a donkey cart and walk after that till you went down to the pier where the boat was, and then a small curragh or something like that, and a miserable wet day, and maybe you drench, get on the boat, your stuff floated into the boat and out, and these heavy seas, and many times. And then when you got the lighthouse, you could maybe have to do 6 weeks on there. At the end of 5 weeks, or maybe the weather would change, maybe a couple of days before you would be due to your relief, the big seas would get them, a big swell, or westerly gales, and no boat could arrive.
And for Sean, the Atlantic winds also brought the ghosts.
Some people would say that they would hear footsteps going up the stairs. and they would go and investigate and see some of their workmates. Were they up the stairs or were they not, or where were they? They said no. So it was a mystery here, all right. And one or two of them verified that they were convinced, actually, that they could feel their arm or hand being lifted up above their head, and they would jump up and switch on a light, and they could see nothing. I give the impression that there was some kind of a spirit around, whether it was an old lightkeeper or what it was back again, we do not know. Many lighthouses have different, you know, stories.
But he looks back with nostalgia and maybe regret at the way things have changed.
It makes me sad to see that there was so much effort, expense and everything put into all the lighthouses, all the best of material, and the last 10, 15 years, this appeared to me, they can't get rid of them quick enough, everything's of the cheapest, nobody seems to have any interest, and it makes me sad, but I got a good life out of it. When I joined the job, the way everything had to be maintained, and lighthouses were always kept spotlessly clean, well looked after, and lightkeepers were always famous for that.
But for Sean Dougherty, time never stands still. As one era ends, another begins. Remember that, Kayleigh. He's a grandfather and almost 75, an age when most men are enjoying their retirement. Now, Sean has bought the Harbour View Hotel.
It's unbelievable how, you know, for me, he should be retired. I have enough hobbies at home, interests at home to keep me going, but I don't know. I just have to hope for the best, hope for good weather, and that the people will come to the island. I don't get any sympathy from home. They said they didn't tell me to buy it, and I have to suffer the consequences. So all I can say is, so far, so good. I've been quite happy, quite lucky with it, and but I'll need to touch wood with that, you know.
Kieran Devaney talking to Sean Dougherty, with thanks to Trevor Sweeney. Staying with a lighthouse-related theme, we've had a note from Deirdre Lane of the Irish branch of the Nautical Institute that on Wednesday next in Sydney, the annual general meeting of the Nautical Institute will elect Captain Robert McCabe to the presidency of that body for a 2-year term. The Institute has 6,500 members worldwide across 110 countries. The Sydney branch will host the International Annual General Meeting of the Institute on the 17th of June at the Maritime Museum in Darling Harbour as part of a conference on navigational competence. An Irish master mariner, Captain McCabe is Director of Operations and Navigation Services at the Commissioners of Irish Lights and previously served with Irish Shipping. Congratulations from all at Seascapes. A major conference begins on Wednesday next, the 18th of June, at the Printworks Dublin Castle. Our Ocean Wealth is the first annual review of the implementation of Harnessing Our Ocean Wealth. The conference will focus on achievements to date, sustainable growth and employment opportunities for the future, and the actions required to drive progress. You can read more on the Seascapes webpage. Next to the waters of Dublin Bay and Hugh Oram on the first sporting event broadcast by radio.
What a remarkable achievement. The world's first ever sports event broadcast on radio was a yacht race that was staged offshore from what is now Dunleary all of 115 years ago. That great radio inventor Marconi, who of course had lots of Irish connections, was the man behind this pioneering radio event. All the intricate details of getting things ready was left to one of his assistants, George Kemp. but Marconi had decided that organising wireless coverage of the regatta to be held off Kingstown, as it was then called, between July the 19th and 22nd, 1898, would provide excellent publicity for his new medium, radio. Just before the event off Kingstown, Marconi and his team had been working successfully in sending wireless transmissions to and from Rathlin Island and Ballycastle on the North Antrim coast. Then they switched their attentions to covering the Kingstown regatta. The idea was for the Marconi team to be based on a tug and send signals with the waste results from there to a station on shore from where they could be transmitted to Dublin. What's fortunate for historians is that the comprehensive handwritten notes that George Kemp compiled have all been preserved for posterity, and they're all easily accessed on the internet. Marconi had another stroke of good fortune. The Dublin Daily Express decided it would back the ventures financially, and in return ran lots of copy all about the event, which is also easily accessible. On July the 8th, George Kemp put all the boxes of equipment on the train for Kingstown, and he took the 3 p.m. train that day to the seaside resort. The following day, a further half ton of equipment arrived, which he had transported by cart. Kemp then said that he wanted to select a site for the mast and went to Doyle's boatyard, where he saw a fine topmast. Kemp paid Mr. Doyle the grand sum of £2.10 for a set of spars and a lower mast, and then he borrowed the topmast. And from these items, a wireless mast was put up in the garden of the harbour master's house. The next step for George Kemp was to do a deal to use the Flying Huntress tug, which belonged to the Clyde Shipping Company. The arrangement was that all the details of what was happening in the various races would be picked up by the radio crew on the tug and then transmitted to shore. Altogether, some 700 radio messages were sent, and from the base beside Kingstown Harbour, these were then sent to the Dublin Daily Express. The clubhouses of various sailing clubs up and down the East Coast then got the results almost instantaneously by telegraph from the newspaper office in Dublin. Some of the races were staged in foggy conditions, but this made no difference to the wireless coverage. And on the last day of the races, July 22nd, George Kemp raised the height of the transmitting mast on the tugboat to 27 metres, which meant the signals could be picked up within a 5-mile radius. The whole experiment was deemed a great success. All the hard work for it had been done by George Kemp and his team of workers, while Marconi himself did a little grandstanding showing off all the virtues of this new medium to various bigwigs. By July the 24th, all the equipment in Kingstown had been dismantled, and as George Kemp noted, all accounts had been settled up. It had all turned out to be a great step forward in sports reporting. In the summer of 2013, the whole event was brought back to life again, and very successfully, by the Maritime Museum in Dunleary and Ye Old Hurdy-Gurdy Museum of Vintage Radio in the old Martello Tower in Howth Village. The entire complete atmosphere of that wonderful occasion back in 1898 was faithfully brought back to life, a great occasion indeed.
As the Clipper race has now left New York, bound for Derry, Seascapes caught a quick word with Derry skipper Sean McCarter on the pontoon before they boarded.
Our arrival in New York is almost a week ago now, but it was fantastic. We came in, motored in at night, flat calm seas. We sailed right by the Statue of Liberty, and it was all lit up. But just really, really beautiful entry. It's quite nice as well because we knew we'd be getting the views in daylight as we departed. So it was nice to get the contrast, to see the lower Manhattan skyline and it's been a really nice time. We're almost home. It's almost over. You know, it's been a whirlwind but unbelievable year for everybody on board. It's sort of coming to an end, and the conversations on deck are starting to change to, you know, what are you doing next, as opposed to what are you doing at the next stopover. So I've told the guys from the beginning that it's really important to have an answer to this question, because it is the kind of thing that eats away at you if you don't. You know, you need to look to life afterwards. But most of the guys are in great form, and some are even, you know, planning their next sailing trips, which is amazing. But it'll be a while before I get on a boat again, I think. The Derry stopover in the last race was, by all accounts, was if not the best stopover, it was, you know, in the top two best stopovers of the last race. And that was without the people of Derry really knowing what Clipper was all about. So I think this time around they know what to expect, and I think it's going to be massive, even compared to the last time. So I've been trying to prepare the crew for this as well. Combined with the Maritime Festival that starts on the 21st of June and runs all week, the city are expecting, I think, over 400,000 people to pass through the city. And I mean, it's only a small city anyway. It's, you know, just over 100,000 people. So it's going to be incredible, the atmosphere. And I mean, there are events planned for all ages all week. So yeah, I fully expect it to be a very memorable event.
Seascapes will be featuring the Clipper Ventures Round the World Yacht Race arrival in Derry for their Maritime Festival on the programme of Friday the 27th of June. You can read more on our webpage, www.rte.ie/radio1/seascapes. Dalkey Rowing Club are holding the Dalkey Regatta at Scotsman Bay, Sandycove, this Sunday. Next week here on Seascapes, we feature the story of the RMS Taylor. We talk to author Jill Hoffs about her recently published book by Pen and Sword, The Sinking of the RMS Taylor, The Lost Story of the Victorian Titanic. We've details of a walking festival on Bear Island, a special commemoration on Whiddy Island on the site of the former US Naval Seaplane Base. Details on how to vote for young sailor Finn Lynch in the Nissan Generation Next competition, Norman Freeman on prunes and the Prohibition Police in Bombay, all that and much more here on your maritime programme. Until next Friday night, tight lines and fair sailing.